I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE in a week that saw Elon Musk's X censor our journalism. Such is the power of the Tesla oligarch that at the time of this show, X has refused to explain why. We used to have free speech on X even under Genocide Joe's regime in Washington. You can now follow us on my personal account at Afshin Ratansi. Elon Musk's censorship came just weeks after we tweeted our interview with President Trump's new deputy assistant. Us tweeting about Palestinian energy resources in Gaza and American dissident Noam Chomsky outlining Israel's repeated violation of peace agreements. Our shows are still up on Rumble. We're appealing to Musk and anyone at X who has answers, or if you know anyone who can help, please reach out to us. Here in Dubai, the UAE held its annual World Government Summit this after the UAE outright rejected Trump's plan for ethnically cleansing Gaza after the 15 months of Biden-Harris NATO-armed genocide in Palestine. Trump's Secretary of State is due in the Middle East today. That after Netanyahu arming European leaders meeting in Munich today have been watching Trump's VP J.D. Vance, who met with Ukrainian dictator Zelensky yesterday. Given the rise of BRICS and the dying pains of US empire, now might arguably be a good time to ask, does the United States have a future? Well, Professor Gilbert Doctorow wrote that book, and the former visiting scholar at Columbia University's Harriman Institute joins me now from the EU capital, Brussels, in Belgium. Professor Doctorow, welcome back to the show. You know, before we even get into the nitty-gritty here, I understand new volumes by you are appearing in 2025, or are scheduled to, War Diaries, war referring to the proxy war on Russia through Ukraine. What did you make, let alone Munich summit, Hegseth at Brussels in front of NATO defence secretaries, appearing to say, you know what, after 1 million dead Ukrainians, 25% territory gone, 7 million plus displaced, bankruptcy of Ukraine, no NATO membership, no EU security guarantees, if anything, $500 billion of debt in minerals to the USA, Nord Stream bombing for nothing as regards Germany, and basically, that's it. NATO troops are not going to be in Ukraine, and Ukraine has to give up their land.
There's a lot of news. In fact, the journalists of the world are overwhelmed by the initiatives.
Not sure we should call them journalists, Professor Doctorow.
those who are putting out the daily briefings that most of the public reads, call it disinformation, call it what you will. The point is that Mr. Trump has a flurry of initiatives every day which capture the imagination of media, both mainstream media and, let's be honest about it, alternative media. The question is, what is he actually intending to do? And the question arises because of the distance between between his words and his actions. The something we've noted a long time ago, he is given to bluster, to exaggerated threats as a method of negotiation, of softening up his talking partners and making them amenable to solving things as he would like. Regrettably, what is missing in all of this is a sense of reality, a sense of being well-informed. In this regard, I think one thing we should direct attention to is the continuity in ignorance in our decision-makers in Washington and in Europe before Mr. Trump's appearance on the stage and after his appearance on the stage. The astonishing statements that were made by Tony Blinken in his last press conference before departing office. He was reciting all of the principles or the concepts that had guided him during his period in office with respect to Russia and the war in Ukraine. And everything was delusional. Everything showed an absolute inability to absorb what he could find in the daily newspapers if he ever opened them. The same is true of people around Donald Trump today, and of Trump himself in his statements.
Let's get to that, Professor Doctorow. I want to get to that and name them because, I mean, as you imply, the journalists have to quickly swivel around what they've been saying for 2 years defending this obvious defeat that was coming for NATO powers, because they seemed to try and make out that this wasn't a huge concession when, as you refer to it, Blinken was saying, no, everything, Crimea, all part of some new NATO idea. Naming the personnel, who is General Kellogg, the cornflake descendant, who seemed to be saying only the other day that there was some idea that sanctions enforcement... He was telling the New York Post, owned by Rupert Murdoch, that sanctions enforcement on Russia are only at 3 on a scale of 1 to 10. Just tell us who Kellogg is and how that goes to support what you're saying about the people around Trump giving him clearly... well, giving him lies with which to somehow handle this situation.
The problem is that people like Kellogg are in high positions. They have, he's a general, after all. And
Ukraine
they are, yes, he is the emissary that Donald Trump chose. He's made very peculiar choices in the opening days of who will be the power ministry people, the people who are answerable to him and to the country for security, domestic and international, for foreign policy. He's taken people who nominally have been on the other side of these issues from what he was saying during his electoral campaign. And he has the expectation that they will follow his orders and do his bidding. And in that way, by taking people who are not disposed to his interpretation, he is going to be able to deal with the uniparty in Congress in a constructive way, and to have them approve what he is going to recommend to them. This is a tactic. It may succeed, it may not. Mr. Kellogg is part of this tactic, someone who is not a believer in finding an accommodation with Russia, not just the end of the war, but an accommodation with Russia, which was from the very beginning, it's clear, Mr. Trump's intention. The problem with all of them and with Trump himself is that they are misinformed. Now, there are explanations. I'm on a number of different very reputable and authoritative interview programs. And my peers, who are interviewed separately in these programs, are military experts and CIA people. And they all come to one conclusion, that the CIA and the other intelligence agencies in the States have been feeding to the president and to everyone who has a right to this intelligence briefings that are made day by day. They've been feeding them essentially what they pick up in Kiev. And they pass it along as God's truth, without any attempt to check it, to find other sources. In a word, the top people and decision makers in the States have been fed lies and propaganda for the last 3 years by the intelligence agencies, of which the CIA is the most prominent. However, there are problems with that explanation. And the problems have come up particularly in the last month or so, when the main purveyors of lies and propaganda are mainstream media, like the Financial Times, like the New York Times, have changed their tune and are giving day by day factual information about the Ukrainian losses, about the Russian gains, and about the trajectory of the war now leading directly to a Russian victory. If these gentlemen ever picked up the New York Times and threw away the trash they're receiving from the CIA, they would be saying very different things. Mr. Trump, Mr. Kellogg, J.D. Vance, they all would be saying something different. Instead, we hear that the war is terribly costly in lives and it's a stalemate. It is not a stalemate. Only the CIA would tell you it's a stalemate. The news that we get day by day in mainstream, I'm not talking about alternative media. I'm not talking about cheerleaders for Russia. I'm talking about mainstream information, say,
to an extent. I've noticed that shift too. And of course, we know Tucker Carlson was in the White House in the past few days. We know his views. He interviewed Putin and has been continuously talking about how the narratives in the media available to American citizens, let alone in the totalitarian European Union where you are, where it's banned to talk about the Nazis of Ukraine, where RT, as I understand it, is banned where you are. The Twitter RT is banned in the European Union. You're not allowed, are you, where you are in Brussels, to receive information, perhaps even that, like the New York Times is now printing. You wouldn't have been allowed to read that a few months ago.
Well, yes and no. Look, the situation in Europe is bad, but not quite as horrible as you're suggesting. RT is under a ban, that's clear. But yeah, you can watch, and I watch, Russian news every day for
Russian. In Russian.
And frankly speaking, as I know, there are a few people out there who know Russian. And the point is that the Russian news is vastly better than any of the English language productions that RT was putting out. And they are available. They're available on various internet.
It's difficult, you know, it's difficult for a person on 5 zero-hour contracts to access this kind of thing, obviously. And it's easier, arguably, to, I don't know, go to a concert or go to your local library, public library, where you'll find that mysteriously some books are being bought by the public library and some aren't, I think one would argue. But on this idea of sanctions, then, let's just quickly go to sanctions. Trump claimed that sanctions are a way of leveraging Zelensky. And then he kind of seemed to be appearing to say, not leveraging Zelensky over to accept any terms, but to get these titanium and lithium minerals out of Ukraine. I think we both know, actually, they're not in Ukraine anymore. They're in what Russia considers Russia now. So what do you think it'll be, wheat fields? Because Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, was there ahead of today's Munich summit.
We're talking about fake news. This whole story, which was originally, goes back to Zelensky himself. This was 2 months ago that he was proposing that Ukraine's mineral wealth be put on offer to the States or to Europe as a guarantee for the payment of equipment that is being delivered to Ukraine. Now, this was put up then. It's now been revived as if it was a newly discovered idea in the Trump White House. But there's nothing to it. It is simply smoke and mirrors for the unsuspecting and uninformed public. This question has been dealt with on Russian talk shows and by very authoritative experts who have said that, oh yes, these rare metals and titanium, not just the rare earths, but metals like titanium, lithium, which have great value today, they exist in Ukraine and they're spread out in many different places. So I don't quite agree with you that they're all in the Russian sector. Maybe 30% of this lithium or titanium are in the 25% of the landmass that Russia is now occupying. There, but the main point is that this is not a new continent that's just been discovered in the middle of the ocean. Ukraine has been around for a long time. It was part of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had one of the most world's leading extractive mineral industries. They mined everything imaginable in the Russian Federation, and they never spent much money developing the extraction of these minerals in Ukraine for a good reason.
Tell you what, we'll get back to this in part two.
It's not commercially viable.
We'll get back to this in part two. Professor Gilbert Doctorow, I'll stop you there. More from the author of Does the United States Have a Future after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the author of Does Russia Have a Future and former chairman of the Russian Booker Literary Prize, Professor Gilbert Doctorow. Professor Doctorow, we were talking about the minerals in the end of part one. You were saying, actually, it's been over-egged, this idea that it's all in the Russian now, parts of Russia, parts of Ukraine. There are rare earth minerals. Will Trump get a hold of them? You were saying that they haven't been really that developed since the Berlin Wall came down and before.
They weren't developed because they're not worth developing. There are many minerals of all kinds. There are hydrocarbons of all kinds spread over the whole globe. But there are very few concentrations of where they're extracted. And they're extracted where it's commercially viable. It is not commercially viable to extract them in Ukraine. The geology is such that it doesn't pay to do it. If it paid to do it, the Soviets would have done it, and they didn't. So this is hot air. It is a distraction from the real issue of, do we supply or don't we supply arms to Ukraine? And if the issue is advanced, if they say that there's something to extract from Ukraine, it's only for an argument, a false argument, to justify continuing to send arms to Ukraine and continuing to lie about the real state of the war, which is not a stalemate, but an impending Russian victory and an impending Ukrainian defeat.
But then we should be
capitulation.
But the arms, as far as we understand it, from the United States are still going there, and presumably Zelensky and those neo-Nazis that are part of the armed forces of Ukraine will think now is the time to increase the amount of asymmetric terror offensives as the last gasps, as you imply, of a losing battle. I mean, should Russia now be expecting more terror attacks? I know there have been since Donald Trump took office.
It's unforeseeable. But you engage in terrorism when you are losing on the battlefield in traditional warfare. So every effort by Ukraine to murder generals, to murder the founders of the militias in the Donbas, as they have done in the last 2 months, these are demonstrations of their weakness, not of their strength. What we have to await is the capitulation. The Russians now are within close distance to Pokrovsk, which is the last major fortified center in the middle of Donetsk Oblast or region. And once that is taken, which is likely in the next several weeks, there will be a clean drive to the Dnieper River. The Ukrainian troops have very little possibility of falling back and of building defenses and protecting themselves against the coming onslaught. This is why the Kremlin is unwilling to proceed to a ceasefire. It is on a roll. It has taken a long time to reach this momentum that they're now enjoying. And they want to see it through to the end, as the vast majority of Russians want to see happen.
Yeah. What about then the British? The British have been closely involved in the proxy war, not just because UK PM Boris Johnson, who's been in Dubai actually this week, famously scuppering the peace negotiation in Turkey, which would have arguably saved so many lives. In effect, he helped kill and end so many of those lives. Does it have any wider repercussions if Sir Keir Starmer of Britain does what some sources are claiming, that he would put British soldiers into the conflict? Pete Hegseth, the boss of the Pentagon, Trump's boss of the Pentagon, saying, look, you can individually, European countries, put people in there, they're just not under a NATO umbrella. Any real repercussions of the mass slaughter of British soldiers in Kiev or in parts of Ukraine? Presumably the Russians would slaughter them all? Or is that just a separate sidebar, obviously terrible for the British?
These remarks by Starmer and the previous behavior by Boris Johnson, they are bravado. They're empty, and serious Russians are laughing up their sleeve about this. The whole ground force of Britain is 50,000 men. The Russians have now more than a million men-at-arms, going close to a million and a half. To speak about the 50,000-man force, if Britain were to send its entire army to the front, it would be wiped out, and then you would have who would be left to protect Britain? A few policemen with their bobby hats. This is absurd. This is the situation back in the Iraq War was, and the lead up to that was that the Brits were the poodles to the Americans. Unfortunately, this has moved on, and the British today, in the person of Johnson and now Starmer, they are the attack dogs. They have moved ahead and out in front of the United States, and they are exposing themselves to the utter hatred and contempt of the Russians. If there were to go to be an escalation, Britain has a bullseye written all over it.
But Trump could tell them to go. Trump doesn't seem to have much time for the current British government. I should just say the British people, thankfully, like in so many other European countries, these leaders have very little political capital with which to deploy huge numbers of troops to the meat grinder.
Yes, this is all empty talk. The Europeans, 25 out of 27 European leaders, are conformist and cowards, and they're shaking in their boots today as to what the Americans will do. If America pulls out of supporting Ukraine and says, boys, it's yours, they know very well that they will drop the ball. They have no ability to provide equipment, provide manpower, to provide the air cover and the intelligence, real-time intelligence, that has been provided by the United States. In short, they are unable to assist Ukraine in any significant way, absent American participation. There are 2 out of 27 national leaders who are ahead of the rest in facing reality, and they are not friends of Putin. They are simply realists. So the meeting that took place last weekend between the far right leaders of Europe, which includes, of course, Marine Le Pen and Salvini from Italy, they have taken heart from the positions of Donald Trump. And so there is a bit more dissonance at high levels within Europe. I think it is a matter of the near term that Europe will crack finally, since everyone is now running for cover in the face of Mr. Trump's very aggressive plans for revising trade relations with Europe. Therefore,
What a sacrifice they made and their peoples made with the increase in heating costs and inflation and so on. I should say that it was not only does the USA have a future that you've written as a collection of essays, does Russia have a future? Russia obviously believes, or the Russian government does, that out of this terrible proxy war has come advantages because of the sanctions, because of the new links to China and Iran and to India and so on. Of course, I have to just finally wrap up by asking you about how refreshing you thought it is that Trump ended the aerial bombardment of Gaza and the actual kinetic genocide, at least for a few weeks since he came into office, and then refreshingly explains that it's about ethnic cleansing and has united the entire world against the policies of, say, the NATO policies as regards Palestine, Israel, here in the UAE, allied to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, to Russia, to China, to everyone is now on board for realizing that the Zionist project is a lethal and despicable one.
It's very early to draw any conclusions about what Trump is doing and what he's planning. As I said, he's a master showman, and he has his own understanding of how negotiations should be prepared. It's one thing to say, yes, he did wonders ending the daily bombardments of Gaza.
They might have started by the time people are watching this, of course, we have to say.
Well, it might resume. Nonetheless, that was outstanding that he managed to achieve a ceasefire. What is receiving less attention is that he has put a firm net on the plans of Netanyahu to attack Iran. The relations with Iran are not very good. I was personally hopeful that there was an outreach from the Trump administration to Teheran for negotiations.
In fairness, they arguably may have been. It's the Iranian government that say, no, we will never negotiate with the Trump administration. As far as I understand it, that's Iran's position, because there's no point in believing Donald Trump. And, of course, Donald Trump was the man who's crowing about killing General Soleimani, the man who successfully defeated ISIS, arguably.
I believe, on the contrary, I believe that there were background talks between Tehran and Washington, and that the Tehran was very hopeful, not just the president, but the supreme leader was hopeful, that this would lead to an accommodation with the United States, putting the confrontation that goes back to 1980 at rest and proceeding to something like normality.
That's President Pezeshkin's argument
for that is the nature of the long-term comprehensive cooperation that Russia concluded with Iran a couple of weeks ago. We all expected that would have in it a component of mutual defense. It didn't. And the fact that it was absent was by the obvious understanding of both Moscow and Tehran that there was about to be an accommodation of some sort with the United States, and that it was inappropriate to, in advance of that, to have a military alliance between Russia and Iran. So there was the expectation. Regrettably, Mr. Trump entered into this planned negotiation like a bull in a china shop, proceeding to say about Iran the same as he has done in advance of negotiations with Mr. Putin. We impose more draconian sanctions on you, and then you will come and negotiate with us, and we will deal with you from a position of strength. That was his obvious intention. Regrettably, it didn't work. Regrettably for him, and I'd say at the moment for the Iranians. The
remarks. Doctor, we have to return to. We're out of time. We'll have to return to it. Hopefully, we won't be at war by then, or at least the United States won't be at war by then. Professor Gilbert Doctorow, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's it for the show. We'll be back on Monday to ask a former CIA and US State Department official how far Trump is again being undermined from inside his own administration. Until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, or indeed it's not censored by Elon Musk. Otherwise, watch Going Underground TV on Rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.